which will then put them 40 something years old.
No,
50. 50, almost 50 years,
years old.
Old.
50 years old when they're done.
50.
Yeah. Wow.
That's insane for a fighter aircraft. Insane.
All players, low down, active, bullseye, 1, 3, 2, 7. Put that.
Fight's on. Welcome to The Merge, where we make sense of defense in an enjoyable way. If you've just stumbled across this podcast, I'm Mike Benitez. I'm going to be your guide through all things defense tech, trends, and happenings that are shaping modern national security. It's serious stuff, but we like to keep it lively around here. And if you're not careful, you might actually learn something along the way. All right, before we get started, we're going to go and we're going to go out and bring you this content and bring you some amazing guests and insights, people that are insiders with experience and they know what they're talking about. And it's all completely free. But in return, if you will take 5 to 10 seconds of your time, leave us a rating on whatever platform you're listening or watching us on, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, doesn't matter. Do it on all of them if you want. That would be great. And oh, by the way, if you're on YouTube, go ahead and give us a comment in the show notes. Same thing with Apple. Give us a review. It helps the algorithm out and shares it to other people. Okay, that's it. Thank you for your service. Admin is complete. If you've been listening to this, we were at episode 20. We made it, and we're recording this like just at 1 year ago. We started this thing off as a feedback from our newsletter readers. We said, hey, what do you want us to do next? And overwhelmingly, everyone said, do a podcast. So here we are. It's your fault, not mine. If you've been listening for the last few episodes, we've been mixing it up. We try to keep mixing things up, and today is no different. This is going to be our first international military episode, and it's our first one, and we don't want to venture too far. And so today we're going to venture a little bit north. We're going to talk about Canada, specifically the Royal Canadian Air Force. We're going to find out what's going on with the northern neighbor. It turns out a lot. And I honestly have been tracking it too closely, and so I'm not the expert, but we did get a guest today who is. Our guest today spent over 2 decades in the Royal Canadian Air Force as a fighter pilot during a key modernization era. After he left service, he became a test pilot, flew for another 20 years in fighters for Lockheed Martin, mostly an F-16, F-35. We venture in a lot of the same circles, and today he is still doing his thing as one of the lead air power advocates for Canada. And so, Billy Flynn, welcome.
Paco, thanks for having me. You know, it's funny, you contacted me about doing this. It was while I was listening to an episode of The Merge, riding my bike, and you sent me an email and said, hey, want to talk about the RCAF? And it was timely. So thanks for having me on.
Better lucky than good. Story of my life. Before we get started, because I was actually wondering this, it's the Royal Canadian Air Force. Is it the RCAF, the RCAF, or the RSAF? How do you truncate that?
It's the RCAF, and no one's ever called it any different that knows it from back in my father's days through today. So RCAF is the only way it's ever pronounced.
All right, that was my number one question. I'm like, I don't want to screw this up. So we got that out of the way, the RCAF. So Billy, why don't you give us a rundown? And I was looking at it a little bit, and I'm like, man, this is not what I think of as a normal structured Air Force. It's structured differently. It has different roles and missions than the United States Air Force. And so if you want to give us just an overview, like what is the mission of the RCAF, and then how does that translate into kind of their force structure?
So perfect. I'm going to start with two caveats. Okay. Because I'm going to get less than complimentary of the state of affairs here as we go along. But I want to start with, look, I'm a 23-year veteran. I commanded in combat. My father is a vet. My mother was a vet. My wife was an RCAF vet with combat time. Her father was a vet. Her brother was a vet. It runs deep rooted in my family. In those 23 years and really growing up with a father in the Air Force, I have been exposed to the most professional, skilled, and dedicated servicemen and women that you would find. I would put them pound for pound, man or woman, against any military that I've ever been associated with. I took them to war. They were extraordinary war fighters. And the men and women that serve today are as good as they've ever been. The service itself, never in its 100 years has it been in such a desperate state. Let's talk about what the real mission is for Canada. Remember that Canada is a non-warring nation. Canada and the U.S. are two countries divided by a common language. And so when we look in here in the States, and I'm in Southern Maryland at home right now, when we look view things as an American, as a warring nation, that's not how Canada views itself. The last time Canada had a war on its soil was the War of 1812, and Canadians are convinced that they actually won, and not since then. Yeah, and they'll tell you that too, by the way. And there's a real important relationship that goes with the government, the press, and the media, and it's been hammered in over the many years by politicians to us when I was a Lockheed Martin F-35 guy. There's a triangle, and it's a relationship between the politicians, the media, and the press, and everything fits up between the three, and everything affects the other. Everyone affects the other, and that's different than here in the United States, where, you know, we're mandated for the number of personnel that are in the Marine Corps, and it's very clear as a warring nation we have to protect in these days against Asia Pacific threat and Russia and support NATO. And there's no doubt in the minds of Americans that the military is needed, and that is not the same in the peace loving nation of Canada. And what are the roles in Canada? The military's job is to defend the homeland, really. There's no direct threats there, but as part of the North American structure, then it's a part of NORAD. And, oh, by the way, it occupies the largest backyard into North America, is the fence line across the Arctic. And, oh, by the way, that is the largest space that needs to be protected. And it is essentially, in this day and age, a backyard with no fence. Canada has its obligations to NATO as an original member of NATO. Back in the Cold War days, we had army based in southern Germany. I flew in southern Germany, southeast of Ramstein, where we had a wing of F-18s. Before that, it was CF-104s. Before that, way back when, it was F-86s in my dad's days. And post-Cold War, Canada kind of shrunk back in and helped with policing or occasional deployments, but really focused more on North America. So in this day and age, think of it as NORAD, and you and I are going to talk about that. And then think of NATO support, whatever it can, from a deployed capability.
Well, that's my start. That's a great intro. No, that's a great intro. And I'm glad you brought up that triangle, because I think it's going to come into play with a lot of the discussion items that we're gonna kind of talk about. But for everyone that's tracking that's it from the United States, and I really appreciate Billy's perspective of how he laid that out. For perspective, the RCAF size-wise is about 12,000-ish people and about 269 aircraft, something like that. So it's it's slightly bigger than the U.S. Coast Guard, okay? And you look at like the geography and the expansion of missions and things that they cover, it's a lot. But they exist for a different reason that we think of from the U.S. perspective. So Billy, we'll start back. Like, let's actually start at the beginning of your career, because I think it gives you that perspective of watching the atrophy or decline as equipment started to age out over the decades. So you started off, you're like the first like baby Hornet guy, right? In the RCAF.
I am. So Canada 40 years ago was in a state where it had second gen fighters, Voodoo, CF-101s, Starfighters, the iconic F-104, and a couple squadrons of F-5s, A's and B's, which I can hardly call them a sophisticated fighter, the baby jet that it was. And those had atrophied and they were old, and Canada eventually decided on buying the F-18 right at the very beginning of its lifetime. At McDonnell Douglas, at the plant in St. Louis, one of every 10 Hornets that came off the line in the beginning went to Canada. And I was a guinea pig project coming up right out of pilot training, where I was told, even before we received the F-18s, that I would be the first kid to go fly that airplane. And that the trial was to see if young pilots could adapt to the super sophisticated plastic airplanes that the F-18 promised to be. Video game addicts that we were, we played Pong and Space Invaders. And the mission computers were really two Commodore 64K computers. And they wanted to see if, you know, we could adapt quicker than the older guys who had to transition from 104s and Voodoos and F5s to this super sophisticated fourth gen multi-role airplane. And we populated 50% of every operational squadron from the very beginning with what we call pipeliners. In the Navy, we call them nuggets, but brand new pilots who had never flown a fighter before. And I tell the story often that 4 years in, my peers, the pipeliners, were better than virtually every single fighter pilot who had transitioned from 104s and F5s and Voodoos, because they knew nothing else. And so they completely bought into 4th gen. And when that transformation happened of the Air Force, where we gutted three old fleets and introduced multi-role Hornets in Canada for NORAD, three squadrons for NATO, and then plussed up what we needed for the rest of Canada, that whole Air Force leapt ahead from where it had been. And all of a sudden, it was our frontline Air Force with a remarkably capable airplane that could do so many more roles than ever before. And we took it to war. I commanded a wing of Hornets in the spring of 99, soon to be 25 years ago, in Operation Allied Force. Sorry, before that, we were in Gulf War One. I commanded the wing during Allied Force. And after that, there was Libya, there was Syria. And the jet, for a period, was really, really capable, not on par with a U.S. Navy Hornet or even as good as the upgrades that went to the Eagle fleet or the Viper fleet, but really capable. Mm-hmm. And then over time, you know, it just couldn't keep up. And all of a sudden it was going to be 30 years old. And now we're talking 40 years old.
Yeah.
And what happened over time was politicking that didn't allow it to keep up. And the rest of the Air Force fell behind.
We'll definitely get to the politics. One of the things that it was unique, and I'm glad you mentioned the 1 out of 10, Canada was like not only the first, but probably the largest buyer of Hornets that were coming out of the McDonnell Douglas line. Canada was unique in that they didn't actually go through the Pentagon or really the Navy through FMS. They went through direct commercial sales through McDonnell Douglas. So going from the second gen, the three fleets of second gen to these brand new fourth gen, because you didn't do FMS, you're not really connected tactically to the United States Navy, who also has the F-18s, right? How did that, I mean, you were in the very beginning, the first few years, we were kind of isolated. Like you don't actually have like U.S. tactics that are, you know, being developed concurrently or in parallel. So how did you guys, what were the lessons learned through that?
So for your listeners that don't understand, when a foreign nation buys a product, don't think F-35, but think any other program. Typically, it's a foreign military sales contract and the U.S. government supports that. And there's overhead that goes with it. It could be 5, it could be 7, it could be 10% surtax essentially slapped on top of a contract to pay for really the overhead and the support. And with that often comes training, right? So it's OTU training or conversion training at Luke or pick the place, you know, in the Navy's case, it would have been at Lemoore. And then after that, you're probably going to buy into tactics and follow the program along. That was always the case with the F-16 fleet when the first four European countries bought it. But Canada bought into a direct commercial sale. And ultimately what that got the Canadian Air Force was more airplanes, right? Less money per airplane because you're not slapping the surtax. And so you get more hardware on the ramp. What you don't get is you don't get to follow the Navy and the Marine Corps as they develop their tactics or even to know where they had come from. And if you look at the Marine Corps, they were flying the F-4 at the time. The Navy, dear Lord, they had A-7s, A-4s, F-14s. That's a pretty deep well to draw tactics to develop and push into the F-18. In Canada's case, there were a lot of great drug deals made with the network of IPs at Lemoore so that the Canadian instructors in the beginning had lots of training material, but they adapted everything else. They Canadianized it. And there was nothing for tactics. So here we had a $18 to $25 million F-18, and we were flying it like a CF-101, doing no-lock stern intercepts instead of using our APG-65 radar, which was pretty magical in the day. And then when we went to Europe, we were flying really expensive F-104s at 200 feet, rooting around, doing low-level bombing instead of using our amazing multi-role capability. And it really took 4 years of exchanges and interchanges with programs like the Tactical Leadership Program in Europe to cut and paste Eagle tactics and Viper tactics. And we killed guys early. I was on the first course, and 2 months in, we killed our most talented weapons instructor who was going into that first operational squadron that I was on. And he had his head in the cockpit doing a high to low intercept on a 1,000-foot target and drilled himself into the tundra going 700 knots, never recovered. We had an accident less than a year after that of a former snowboard pilot who got disoriented departing. And then the third class A, although the pilot ejected, was my squadron commander who ran off the end of the runway, missetting his takeoff trim. And our problems continued for a long time because we had to invent tactics or cut and paste them from everyone else. And so this amazingly capable airplane carried the day for years until we actually had a tactics manual and figured out how to use the Hornet the way it should be.
There's a lot of parallels for when you don't buy something for a while and then you buy something new. The thing that's new is generally way better than the thing that was old. And so you have this generational leap. I know like the initial cadre of the F-22, that's kind of the running story in the United States Air Force. When they got the F-22, they had all of the F-15C pilots had transitioned first. And so they're flying it, same formation, same tactics as the F-15C. And it actually took a cross-pollination. So they actually expanded the aperture and brought in F-16 guys, F-15E guys for multi-role. And then they started like questioning, like, why are you guys doing that? Like, I don't know. That's how I learned it. Like, oh yeah, let's try this. Let's try that. So the experimentation, but just cross-pollination of just cultures and personalities and like helped accelerate that. And in that culture, we learned a lot of lessons in the United States Air Force, because when the F-35 came out, we were able to like, hey, have you seen this before? Marine Corps is probably the one that had the biggest leap going from the scarier into the F-35B. It's something that most people don't really think about. They think about, well, here's your weapon system. Like, obviously you're just better now. Like, well, nope. That's only part of it. It's the people. There's a human component to that. So I definitely appreciate.
We were amazingly good because the airplane was amazingly good. We were clueless as tactical aviators, but we had this brilliant slow flying airplane. And so we were great at doing slow speed BFM because nobody else could fly slow, but we had no clue what we were doing operationally. Unfortunately, we didn't have to go to war. And by the time we did go into combat at Gulf War One, you know, the program had matured. It was a 10-year-old airplane, and we'd learned from all the other air forces along the way. So yeah, steep learning curve in the beginning, made some serious mistakes in the introduction of the F-18 fleet way back when.
Let's talk just a little bit about NORAD, and then there's two aircraft programs with backstories and that triangle that you talked about to dig into. So NORAD, United States, Canada.
North American Aerospace Defense Command.
There you go. Canada and the United States have had a very, very good relationship for a long, long, long time. During World War II, there was concerns between the two countries about Russia, which then led in the 50s, it was late 50s, I think 57, 58, the establishment of NORAD. And that was because, like as you alluded to, the threat of, initially it was Soviet bombers carrying nuclear weapons, and then it became ICBMs going across the Arctic towards Canada or over Canada into the United States. And that's where it started. Interestingly, not many people realize this, even though it's called the Air Defense Command, in 2006, they added maritime. So there's a W for water that should be in there, I guess, but there's a maritime warning mission that is part of NORAD, which then dovetails into a conversation we're going to have a little bit about the RCAF's mission is a little different than the US. So Canada has committed a significant amount of money over a long term to modernize all of those systems that comprise NORAD. And like you said, if you know, we buy everything, call it 30, 40, 50 years ago, and then we don't do anything for 30 or 40, 50 years, all those bills are coming due now. It's a backyard with no fence, I think is what you alluded to before, right?
Yep. It's a huge price tag. Canada's the now previous Minister of National Defense committed Canada to, and it's modernizing a bunch of stuff. So the Northern approaches surveillance system is going to replace what is called the North Warning System. So that's over the horizon radars that run from the US-Canada border up to the Arctic Circle, and then a polar over the horizon radars that will go from really, let's call it the Arctic Circle, all the way over the poles, including the Canadian Arctic archipelago. And then some integrate some sensors in that. There's a complete modernization of the command and control and communications, especially in the Canadian context. And then there's lots of money for air-to-air weapons for Canadian fighters. Starts with a 32 AIM-120D buy, but really there's a big pot of money in there for more new infrastructure. So Cold Lake, Alberta, that's the west coast, I think north of Montana, is the Western fighter base. It's being completely modernized in this case now to house the F-18, including a quick reaction QRA, quick reaction alert. You'd think I'd know that, right? QRA facilities. And then Bagotville, which is north of really Maine, is in Quebec. It's all being modernized. Canada just committed to 9 Airbus 330s. 8 of those will be converted to strategic tankers to now give boom and probe and drogue tanking capability to the Air Force. And then finally, there's some science and technology investment, kind of a mini wannabe DARPA, but there's a huge chunk of money over 20 years that this government, liberal government, not very pro-military, has committed to. And it's a pretty, I'll be cynical and say, it's pretty safe to commit money over a 20-year period because they're not going to be in power that much longer. So it's easy to say they'll throw money at it when it's a 20-year time frame. But upgrade the warning system, the surveillance system for the Arctic is a really key part of that, because really we won't be able to protect against cruise missiles and hypersonic weapons if fired against us. And in America, we as Americans need to understand why that matters. Because although there's 54 F-35s at Fairbanks, Alaska, at Eielson Air Force Base, and F-22s in Anchorage, the largest area of North America, essentially unprotected, is the Canadian Arctic. And so being able to sense across into Russia protects all of us. And that Canadian investment is a huge part of protecting us here in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. For those who aren't aware, there's this network, and some of them are manned, some of them are remote and automated systems. And it's this mesh network of radar sites that have this monitoring mission. Some of them are over the horizon, so they bounce off of the ionosphere to go across the pole, across the Arctic. And really what it's trying to do is give you that early warning on what's actually coming. When you get into like air defenses and surveillance, minutes matter. So if you can get an extra 5 or 6 minutes of notice for alert launches or response for air defense weapon systems, those things matter. And really it's about a credible deterrence over the long term. And so committing a $38 billion over a 20-year period, talk about that triangle and the power shifts. We'll see what happens, but it's a significant amount of money. And there's a partnership with the United States where there's some co-funding to help that out. But that's just Canadian slice of the pie. So it's got new communication. It's got some space-based detection, R&D stuff. But one of the things was missiles. So you mentioned the 120D. And so in this $38 billion funding, one of the surprise things that I saw when I was researching this was a new, not medium range, but a long, it specifically says long range air-to-air missile, an LRAM, which is not an AMRAM. And it has a 2030 time frame for an IOC. So it'll be curious to see what missile that actually is. It's not an AMRAM. It's not a JATM. So it's got to be something else out there. So whether it's a Meteor or something else, I'm not sure how it'll be compatible with the new fighter fleet when it starts showing up.
Well, I saw it and I thought, yeah, okay. It's got to fit in an F-35. So where's that going? And what don't we know yet?
Yeah. I'd be curious to see as time goes on. I'll keep an eye on that. That was an interesting call out. But for NORAD, we said it has a maritime mission. This is my terrible segue into talking about one of the unique things about the RCAF is the fact they have a maritime mission. So the Air Force has what we would traditionally think is a Navy mission in the United States. And this gets into maritime patrol aircraft as part of the RCAF. And so right now, Billy, they're done by some kind of a They look like P3s, but they're something else. They're called something else. Auroras, is that right?
Yep. So it's a P3C, but, Canadianized. And over the years, the upgrades have been Canadianized to give it some more of an ISR capability for the 14 of them that are flying. Think of it as a maritime patrol aircraft with the future of some ISR capability. It really hasn't worked out very well. When you try to figure out what the Canadian Air Force does, just think of everything that flies is the Air Force. And so that's search and rescue, that's maritime patrol, that's obviously transport and airlift and refueling and fighters. And that's the way I've always looked at it. So those airplanes are old and they need to be upgraded. There's a wonderful Canadian political brouhaha happening right now over that.
Oh yeah, it's like literally playing out as we're recording this podcast, which I was like, I did not plan it that way. It's just how it's working out, which makes it just great to discuss.
So the Canadian Air Force knew that they needed to upgrade these P3s. It turns out that the Boeing P8 line was potentially running to the end of its time. And so the Canadian Air Force did a study, assessed that there was nothing out in the marketplace that could answer the requirements. And really the conversation started with Boeing. And then in only in Canadian fashion could it happen, Bombardier, who builds business jets and builds airframes for some military unique programs. Bombardier, who's based in Montreal, the powerhouse of Canada, woke up and said, okay, look, how come we can't have a part of this pie too. We have an airplane that's viable. And so they got together with General Dynamics. They have a paper airplane, never flown, no test bed, no technical risk reduction done, and said, look, we're as good as a P8. And they started a very Canadian crowdsourcing program where they gather a political support, not technical support, not military support. They played the Quebec card and the aerospace socialist card and said, look, we want jobs, and claim they have a capability to build an airplane that would be as good as you could get out of a P8 as an ISR and maritime patrol aircraft in a Bombardier business jet. Think of a CRJ that you fly in a regional airliner. And they're out there right now working at it. No prototype, no test bed, nothing to show except graphics. And they've got this whole program on its head. And they have a very real chance of cutting the knees off Boeing, who's about to sell, was about to sell 16 P8s to Canada to get a competition, which would delay in a full-on competition to then ultimately decide who wins. There's history there. Bombardier's predecessor was called Canadair, and Canadair built F5s, CF5s, way back however many years ago, on license from Northrop as a political gesture to keep that aerospace industry viable in Quebec. And the Canadian Army and the Air Force fly Bell helicopters that was politically motivated also. And there is a very real chance that Bombardier can take away the P8 sale because of socialism, not because of capability.
Yeah, right now, this is an $8 billion thing that's stuck in politics. And so originally the sources sought was supposed to be like, what's out on the market and maybe we'll have a competition. And then, like you said, upon further review, the most proliferated maritime patrol aircraft in the world right now is the P8. There's hundreds of them. I think the United States Navy has almost 200 by themselves. They have a hot production line, and they said, hey, you could buy these aircraft. We're already like, there's tactics already out there. People use them as interoperability. They had the request. That was earlier this year. It was about 6 months ago, I think. And then a company called PAL, I think it's PAL Aerospace, is what is taking the Global 6500 and then offering it as, quote, a P6. That's the placeholder. Saab had a very similar plan to use the Global 6500 or 6000 base. It was called the Swordfish. And they actually like left the market because they couldn't find any buyers for it, which should be an indicator, right? So yeah, there's one paper airplane out there versus a larger, presumably more capable, definitely more mature, proliferated P8. Right now, the U.S. ambassador like 2 days ago, I think, as we're recording this, sent a letter back to the Canadian government because Canada requested this offer. The U.S. approved it. And now they're like, you need to sign the deal to get this thing out of the politics that's going on in Canada. And there was a hearing in the House of Commons recently that basically directed I don't know what it's the Pentagon called in Canada. I don't know what it's called.
Department of National Defense. So NDHQ, National Defense Headquarters. So they were directed to go review this, right?
Yeah, they were directed to go review this. And one of the things I thought was interesting is that in that history, he's talked about licensing and co-production and for industrial jobs. I did read that General Dynamics Mission Systems, who has the equipment for the P3s right now, they actually went to Boeing and said, hey, we could put our stuff on your aircraft and, you know, maybe we can work something out politically that way. And that didn't work out for whatever reason. So it's kind of an all or nothing, like take it as it's coming off the line or do something else. In that letter, I didn't know this actually until I read the letter from the ambassador, that there is a U.S.-Canada defense production sharing agreement that basically, if Canada were to spend $8 billion on buying a U.S. aircraft like the P-8, the United States in kind goes out of their way to offset that spending back across the border to buy Canadian equipment. And I was unaware of that agreement. Apparently, it's been going on for like 50 years and I just found out about it. So the whole jobs, and there's probably something about it, the industrial base is probably a bigger argument to make rather than just jobs or income because of that production sharing agreement that I have.
The amount of business, or imagine the amount of business that Boeing does in Canada, even on the commercial side, it's enormous, right? Feeding the lines in Seattle. And so already Canadian industry benefits significantly from this. The P-8 was a smart move. Like, this was cut in base. The tactics exists. You said it. The fleets around NATO are interchangeable now, you know, completely interoperable. This was a smart, seamless move. But Bombardier is playing the political card, and they're actually crowdsourcing. I caught them on LinkedIn looking for, you know, likes of this, and Bombardier's VPs are all over media. Because all you have to do is stir up the hornet's nest enough from Quebec, which is really the center of so much power in Canadian politics, and you're going to stop this procurement and then delay it forever and ever until maybe even the P-8 line is closed. So capability is overrun by socialism in Canadian military affairs. And I said the same thing with F-35. Never count out the political factor in procurement in Canada.
Well, you just gave me my own segue, which was, for those who are listening are like, man, Billy seems like very pessimistic about this in the politics. Well, there's a reason why. He's got a lot of scar tissue, which is our segue into the F-35 program. And it is fascinating and bonkers. There should be a Netflix special just over what happened with the F-35 program in Canada. So we've been alluding to it, so we're going to get to it now. So Billy, there's a roughly 80-ish CF-18s, and they've been in service since the early 80s, and they're going to be in service. They're not supposed to be in service, but they're going to be in service for probably another 10-ish years, something like that, which will then put them 40-something years old.
No.
50. Almost 50 years old.
50 years old when they're done.
50.
Yeah.
Wow. That's insane for a fighter aircraft. Insane.
I'm scarred from the F-35 Canada saga because I essentially lived all of it, but I won. And if I'd lost, if I'd given up, my father would have crawled out of his grave as a former Canadian fighter pilot, you know, and haunted me the rest of my days. In the end, F-35 won in 88. What will be Block 4 F-35s will come to Canada. But it's a saga that began in 2010. The Canadian Air Force technical experts, fighter pilots, and engineers were early signatories in the JSF program. And in 2010, it was announced that Canada was going to join the program. A big flashy announcement in Ottawa with a mock-up in a hangar. But assumptions made by the Canadian staff officers, really my peers, that they really didn't need a competition. There was nothing else that could match the F-35 promise. And so they were just going to sole source this thing and join what was going to be a program of 3,000 airplanes, incredible industrial offsets, which I'm sure your listeners understand yet. It's not offsets, it's industrial benefits. And away they went. But there's a whole lot of buts, which include F-35 did really, really poor in the beginning, didn't it? Us were going through the roof and everyone was choking on the delays and how much the funds were running up. And everybody lost the conversation in Canada. And even as things turned around in the program of F-35, the conversation just kept slipping further and further away. One of the biggest errors I say is when Americans come to Canada, they have to learn to speak Tim Hortons English. And for those who've never been to Canada, Tim Hortons is like Dunkin' Donuts. It's a donut franchise in Canada, and it's essentially in every street corner, in every community. And what I mean by Tim Hortons English is you got to speak Canadian. You can't come in from Lockheed, Fort Worth, Texas, and speak like a bunch of Texans and tell Canadians how to do procurement and how to communicate with the Canadian public. And in that triangle I talked about, media, politicians, and public, Lockheed Martin completely blew the conversation and the communications with the Canadian public. The RCAF did an extremely poor job. They just went deaf mute in supporting F-35. And Boeing was just brilliant. They just had a heyday slaughtering us in the public, in the media, with all the things that we were doing wrong and how a Super Hornet would really be an easy answer and not a troubled program like F-35 was back in the day. And there's some interesting parts of how things could have turned around. In the 2014, early 2015 timeframe, so that's back 8 years ago, there was anywhere from 2 or 4 U.S. Air Force F-35s that were offered to Canada. They were on the line being built, and they would have been pulled off and essentially kick-started the Canadian F-35 program because the airplanes would be delivered right off the bat, and all of a sudden the Canadian Air Force would be in with the jet. And the Prime Minister at the time, Stephen Harper, it was up to him to decide, and he balked. He was in the middle of an election run, and he didn't have the guts to make the commitment. And that led to, in September of 2015, candidate Justin Trudeau, in a speech in Halifax in September of 2015, the three parties in Canada were one-third, one-third, one-third as they were polling. And Justin Trudeau said, look, we will not buy the F-35. And that particular speech pivoted his campaign, and he stole the left third of the polls or the voters, and he won a majority, and he promised not to buy the F-35, and that was it. F-35 was going to be canceled in Canada, and it sat in purgatory for a long time. He got smart, Justin Trudeau. He had a majority, so now it's 2015. He's in power. It's got a majority, and he went to Boeing and said, look, I want to sole source 18 Super Hornets right now to fill an imaginary capability gap that his people invented about NORAD and NATO simultaneous ops, and almost pulled off a sole source buy in the summer of 2016 with Boeing. And then I knew about this early. And then in June of 2016, I was in Ottawa with my F-35 buddies trying to stop this from happening. And what saved us was it was the price tag of the Super Hornets. So something above $6 billion for 18 Super Hornets was the price tag that Boeing asked the Canadian government for. The government choked. And in the end, people think that the deal was canceled because of the Boeing-Bombardier trade dispute over civil airplanes. But that actually wasn't it. The real reason it didn't go anywhere is Boeing had a stunning price tag. And so they stopped buying the sole source. And ultimately, it led to a competition, which F-35 won because of some more Boeing missteps. In the end, we get to really this winter, past winter, where thank God Vladimir Putin was in the Ukraine and gave the Liberal government, who had promised never to buy F-35s, the excuse that the world had changed and Canada committed 88 F-35s, there'll be Block 4s, almost $20 billion contract. As you say, I've been there, done that for so long.
Yeah.
Defending the program in Canada and just shaking your head at how embarrassing it is. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a we talk about the A-curl. So there's a, in the initial part of the F-35 program, this is like 2008 to 2010 timeframe. Part of the F-35 is the reprogramming of the defensive suite. And so part of that is like, hey, we have these coalitions, we have different tiers of partners. And so Australia, Canada, and the UK, they were basically going to have all of the same configuration with the same intelligence of sharing. They had a sharing agreement. And so there's a building in the United States in Florida at Eglin Air Force Base. It's called the ACURL. That's the Australia, Canada, UK reprogramming lab. There's a C, but Canada never joined the program. And so like the running joke was like, we're either going to rename the building, drop the C out of the name, or they're going to come back around. It's like, I don't know what's going to happen first. I was in the wing that had that building. It was kind of the running joke. Why is there a C? Like, don't worry about it. It'll work out. But actions have consequences, right? So although they're getting more F-35s than they originally planned, and although they're getting better configuration F-35s at a cheaper price, time is something that you can't buy back. So those CF-18s that are in service right now, they have to limp along and for at least a few more years. And so you start, I think the first Canadian F-35 shows up in 2026. And then, you know, 88 F-35s, that takes a little bit of time to layer in because you have all of these other people in line buying F-35s and the line only produces so many. And so you got to get in line where you can start pulling them and, you know, drug dealing where you can get your jets in front of other people. And so it'll be probably early 2030s, like we talked about, till they're all delivered. And then the last, the Hornets are coming out of service. And so the stopgap, if I remember this right, was they were getting mothballed Hornets from Australia, right, to fill the fleet.
Really stunning. It'll be such a waste of money. Ultimately, 18 Aussie A's and B's came over to Canada, had to spend a ton of money, in good Canadian term, a hockey sock full of money, to Canadianize them to make them the same standard as the Canadian airplanes. If the original timeline had fed along, then really it would have been like Australia. Canadian Hornets would have been going out of service at 30 years, and they would have all been done by 40 years. But this delay that I explained really cost 10 years to the program. So instead of retiring jets at 40 years, the beginning of transition will happen now that the airplanes are 40 years old, and they will be flying till they're 50 years old. It'll be 2035, I think, by the time the Canadian F-35s show up. 2026 at Luke. Some jets will come to Canada in 2028 if the timeline sticks and the infrastructure is ready. 2032 IOC, but you know, you're not going to plus up and fit all the squadrons till 2035. So a 10-year delay, it means nothing to Canadian politics and either party, honestly, about capability. But to the Air Force, commander of the Canadian Air Force has said publicly in a speech a couple weeks ago, Canada can't conduct peer-on-peer conflict because those really old F-18s won't survive. They've had some of them have had one upgrade. It's called the Hornet Extension Program, and there'll be another version called HEP, Hornet Extension Program 2. And the real irony is that once they're finally upgraded, they will be retired, which, by the way, there's so much history in the Canadian Air Force. It happened with the F-5 way back when. The fleet was modernized and then retired right off the bat. And, oh, by the way, the venerable T-33 was upgraded and then retired. And so there's a real history in Canada of upgrading airplanes already obsolete, then retire them as soon as the upgrade packages are done. And then Canadians are going to buy F-18s around at air shows, and I don't know what they're going to do, sit as a third-tier NATO Air Force until the F-35s show up. Not encouraging.
Yeah, that's not good. So there's a lot of lessons learned in history. We talked about the second order effects, which was the iron But we didn't talk about the third order effects. So because you have that iron, you don't have that credible air force that's relevant and capable to do the things that are asked of it. So there is a point, and there's about 100 fighter pilots in the RCAF. There's a point where you start breaking faith with the ranks. You expect when you serve that you will be organized, trained, and equipped to do the mission that you are asked. And so when you are not organized, trained, or equipped, you can't do the task that you're being asked. There was a recent think tank, I think it was from the UK, the
Royal United, United K Services Institute. It's a old venerable think tank, and the author of the study, Justin Bronk, so many of us have read his work. I love what he does across many domains in aerospace and defense. And he was given access, he was sanctioned by the Canadian military to write this study. We in Canada all know how bad things were, but he wrote this study anyway, got firsthand effects, got to see everything. And then in a brilliant move by someone, the report was leaked to the Canadian press, and it's out there, and it's stunning. And it just says how desperate the state of the Canadian fighter force is. And I'll correct you in what you said. You said there's about 100 Canadian fighter pilots. There is less than 50 combat-ready fighter pilots in the Royal Canadian Air Force. For the Hornets that exist now, and I don't know, you and I can both do math, 50 pilots does not equal 88 F-35s. Justin Bronk, for the RUSI think tank, wrote this report. It was leaked out into the newspaper called the Globe and Mail. They published it, and then it got even wider distribution through Forbes, and it's all out there now. And it basically says this fighter force is completely non-effective. The morale is just completely tanked. There's no faith in leadership. They've been promised a million things. They fly stunningly obsolete airplanes, and the F-35 is not coming tomorrow, so it's not exactly on the horizon. So, you know, how do you stay motivated when you're flying a 40-year-old piece of what? It flies a decent air show, and that's about it. Oh, by the way, it flew the same air show that I flew, however, 40 years ago also. So nothing motivating for fighter pilots in the Canadian Air Force, and they're all leaving. They're going to WestJet, they're going to Air Canada, they're going to smaller feeders, and they're not staying because they don't believe in the military at all. And so if you have 50 now, everybody's putting fingers in the dike to just keep the guys and gals that are in now, keep them from leaving. All bad, all bad.
As you're relaying that message of what's going on, I did not plan this whatsoever. I have this book that I keep next to my desk because it's really good. It's called Why Air Forces Fail. You ever read this book, Billy?
No.
That's my unsolicited, hey, this is a good book. It's Why Air Forces Fail. And it has about 13 different case studies over the past 100 years from World War One all the way up through the Falklands. It's like, this could almost be an extra chapter in this book. There are some like fascinating reasons why air forces fail. And this is, it's hitting on a couple notes and themes that are in a couple of these case studies.
When you go to talk to the guys and gals, there are the four Fs: flying, fun, family, and funding. And none of those are good news stories in the Canadian Fighter Force right now. And so when senior commanders, who are super sharp guys, look, the Air Force is led by Lieutenant General Eric Kenny. I knew him as a young man. Actually, his dad was my first squadron commander. His mom, okay, quick side tangent. Every young fighter pilot knows in their first squadron that the person that takes care of them is the squadron commander's wife. She takes care of wayward fighter pilots. And I was a dumbass young fighter pilot. And my CO's wife was this wonderful woman. Well, it turns out she's the mother of the commander of the Air Force. So I have a special affection for Eric Kenny because his mom was an amazing squadron commander's wife. And he flew for me in combat in Allied Force. He had a stunning career, and he's in charge now. The Air Force finally has a leader who has to deal with all these problems. And the guys and gals that work for him are super sharp. But look, there's no silver bullet to fix this. The pilot pipeline is broken. There's no throughput. There's no ability to surge. You know the saying, how long does it take to make a 10-year fighter pod?
10 years.
Mm. 10 years. So it's going to take a long time to bring the fighter force back to be healthy. And senior leaders will tell you, I asked one of them in a Chatham House Rules, so I won't name names, but at a recent conference, I stood up and go, okay, you tell me the date when the fighter force is back healthy and there's enough pilots to equal cockpits. And they can't answer that. They can't answer because they know how many they can build per year, but guys and gals are leaving. So they have no ability to stop the flow out or and backfill quick enough. And so it's not getting better. And again, remember how we started? Why does this matter to your audience? Because the protection of North America is the responsibility of the Royal Canadian Air Force. And that Arctic backyard that does not have a fence protected now is the responsibility of those Canadian 40-year-old Hornets. And it won't get better for 10 years till, you know, F-35s are up there. And that's not a comfortable place to be when the Arctic is a key place with climate change for exploitation from China and from Russia. So there's the so what in the conversation. And you said it. Look, I'll get the book. The motivation is just tanked for fighter pilots in Canada. Why would you be motivated to fly a 40-year-old airplane? It's older than every single person that flies it. Holy cow. All because of bad politics and bad leadership over the many years of senior leaders who did not stem the flow or get the equipment in the hands of the men and women that are here to protect us.
Well, well said, well said. So there's another thing here just to be careful. We talked about second, third order effects. Another byproduct of this is if the narrative of pilot production and retention doesn't have an answer, it could quickly turn into, well, we'll just buy less F-35s and that'll solve the problem, which is like, no. Like there's that number came from somewhere. I think that might be one of the risks is that you may try to solve a manpower problem by buying less aircraft. So, hey, we have less cockpits, you know, numerator denominator, it's just math and we can fix this, but that's not in the cards because if you look at a map, like Canada is, you know, not a small nation. There's a lot of geography. And like you said, it's our backyard and we don't really have something up there to respond for the mission for the RCAF. So Billy, if you had, let's go on a little tangent in this conversation before we wrap up. If you had a magic wand and you can't turn back time. If you had a magic wand, what are like one or two things that you would do to help out your homeland for the RCAF?
No more mistakes from this point on. So, one, I would open the doors to reservists. It's a reserves in Canada are not like the reserves or the Air National Guard and or any of the National Guard capabilities in the United States. None at all like that. And I would open up to reservists and I would bring in the Air Canada, the WestJet pilots, the guys who are working in the local areas, you know, Cold Lake, Alberta and Bagotville are not garden spots, but men and women are going to come back to fly fighters. And I would open that up right away because that's going to keep the long in the tooth fighter pilots around while I feed the transition. The second thing I would do is I would go clean house. And what do I mean? Well, look, the military itself has been rocked by sexual harassment scandals. The chief of the defense staff was fired after it was found out that he had a 20-year affair and fathered a child with a former subordinate that he kept quiet for years. His replacement was fired 22 days later for a sexual harassment accusation. Moms and dads come to me all the time and go, why would I send my kid to join the military? You know, they can't clean up their own act. So the second thing I would do is I'd clean house and I'd be squeaky clean moving forward. I'd focus on capability and show the Canadian people that it's an upstanding military as professional as everyone wants to be. And then maybe I could turn the recruitment problem around. And then the third thing I would do is I deal with retention. And money doesn't solve retention. It gets to that 4 F's. I think you've talked about it. I know Rain has. We all talk about, you know, what keeps men and women in. Is it culture? Oh, yeah. Is it the good squadron spirit? All of that. difficult conversation, I'd focus on retention. I would do everything I could to keep men and women from going to the airline bus drivers and make sure that being on squadrons and being fighter pilots and serving their country was something that they wanted to do. So those are the three things I would do. No silver bullet. It's going to be ugly. The 100th anniversary is, the centennial is coming up. Canada's going to celebrate it for a year. I'm super proud. Again, my dad was a fighter pilot. You know, I did my time. All of it is, it'll be enormously proud time, and it'll be a really difficult time to watch the fighter force struggle along until F-35 shows up. I think F-35 will give people a shot in the arm. Why would you want to go be a bus driver when you can go fly a $100 million friggin' spaceship and, you know, be King Kong in a F-35 just to make my F-35 plug for the day? Like, why wouldn't you want to do that? And then go be an airline guy somewhere down the road, right? But go be a fifth gen god out there. And I think that'll be a good recruiting tool in the beginning. And the secret will be to keep the men and women in the military if they stay for F-35. So I do think it'll turn around at some point. I'm such a believer in the men and women that serve in the Air Force that I grew up in. I flew fighters for 40 years, and I flew around the world, and all the amazing opportunities I had in my career start because I grew up in that Air Force, and what I learned from my IPs, my squadron mates, my mentors, my leaders. And I credit every one of the great opportunities I had to the upbringing I had in that Air Force. And I'm such a believer in it, but they got to go do some work. And I got to see strong leadership from this point on, not a bunch of bean pounders or pencil neck geeks in there as leaders, fighter pilots leading and convincing men and women to stay and turning that force around and fighting the politicians to keep the piranha feeding frenzy from chipping away at capability. Oh, that's second rant of the day, isn't it?
That's great. You know why? It just means you care. And that's, I think, a really good note to end it on, is that we started out and I said at the beginning, like, hey, we talk about serious stuff. We like to keep it lively. But at the end of the day, you know, it's protecting lives and saving lives. And you have to be organized, trained, and equipped to do that. And so these are serious topics. So if people want to keep in tune with what's going on, again, you're one of the leading air power advocates for Canada. Where can people connect with you or follow you or figure out, like, you know, what are you talking about? And when you use information, share it, where can people connect with you?
BillyFlynn.com. So Billy is spelt with an IE, which is my call sign. BillyFlynn.com. I have a blog that's up there less frequently these days, but BillyFlynn.com. I'm on social media with the same handle. And I endeavor to put my opinion out there and at least get heard. By the way, thanks for having me on today. I'm passionate about the topic, love the Canadian Air Force, but I also love what you're doing and the conversations that you and you guys have about just keeping us all up to date with what's going on. So thanks for what you do.
Ah, thanks, Billy. And parting shots, we'll put your contact info in the show notes below. Parting shots for everyone. If you're still tuning in, like, follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. That's it. That's the show. See ya.